from Illinois Public Media. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we're going to spend the rest of the hour today on a literary tour of the Midwest. That, in fact, is the subtitle of a book coming out later this month from Three Fields Books, which is part of the University of Illinois Press. It's called Lingering Inland, and it's a collection of short essays by contemporary writers exploring their literary peers and ancestors and what it means to be a writer of the Midwest. In the foreword, the young poet Jose Olivares from Calumet City in the south suburbs of Chicago explains what it meant for him to begin recognizing Chicago as a literary landscape. He writes, "There was art to be made from the steel mills and the concrete and the mall and hours spent on the expressway. There was song in the suburbs. There was literature in the flash-fried foods. There was sculpture to be made from our distinctive drawl." The collection is edited by Andy Oler, a professor in humanities and communication at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. And he joins me now. Welcome to The 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Brian. I'm delighted to be here.
Listeners, you can join us for the rest of the program today, 800-222-9455. What has been your experience with the literary Midwest? Is there a favorite historic site or home or scene from a story that's set here that you visited? Let us know. 800-222-9455 is the number. All right, Andy, let's talk about the book. How did Lingering Inland come to be?
Well, Lingering Inland came about as a development of a series that I edit for the New Territory magazine. The New Territory calls itself the autobiography of the lower Midwest. And it's at its heart, it's a print magazine that includes journalism and short stories and creative nonfiction essays and poetry and photography. It's a lovely magazine. I encourage everybody to check it out. And I pitched to them this series called Literary Landscapes, in which contributors to the series who end up being part of this book visit a place that is associated somehow with Midwestern literature. And so that sometimes is an author house that's become a museum. Sometimes it's a gravesite. Sometimes it is, you know, just a gravel road that's a scene from some poem. All right. And it could be a lot of different things. And we have places that still exist and the remains of places that are represented in this book. And they go and they think about and they write about what about that place is interesting, how it connects to the literature, and how their experience is meaningful in some way. So this was a project that got started right before COVID in early 2020. And we started publishing in June, I believe, just after everything was locked down. So in a lot of ways, this project was like a COVID lifeline because all of these essays are short. They're about 900 to 1,000 words. So like a lot of people at that time, I did not have the stamina or the brain power to really think deeply or carefully about anything in the world. It was just also overwhelming. But when I would get these essays come into my inbox and it was something that people were enthusiastic about, that was meaningful to them, I could help them shape those essays into something that was publishable. And it was an amazing experience. It continues to be an amazing experience. So we worked on this. Yeah, go ahead.
I should say this is perhaps a digression, but I suspect some significant share of art produced in the next generation will have its roots in the, would you say, the houseplants of the pandemic, right?
I think you're absolutely right. And some of the essays in this book are very clearly related to the pandemic. Kella Thornton from St. Louis has a really terrific essay where she, during the pandemic, went and sat on Kate Chopin's she sat on the stoop of Kate Chopin's final home in St. Louis and kind of reflected on Chopin's writing, her experience, along with Kella's at that time. And it was this amazing thing to read, because you could see someone working through that in real time. So I think that exactly that, those kinds of struggles, those kinds of ways of thinking about the world are going to reverberate for years to come. You're absolutely right about that.
Let's
so let's see.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, I'm curious how you defined the Midwest. And this is a, you know, this can be a contentious topic in the academy. I've heard it, you know, stretching all the way from West Virginia to Colorado in some cases. What were you looking at here?
Well, I am at heart an expansive Midwest kind of a guy. And the reason for that is because there are no clear sort of geographical boundaries to the Midwest. I mean, you can probably put the Ohio River as one. You might be able to say the Great Lakes, but that's a limited boundary. The Great Plains is sort of a, you know, a boundary, but it's not exactly. So I was trying to think about the Midwest as places that share certain cultural streams. So one of the development of the Midwest, of the idea of the Midwest, came about when you had a sort of these northern Yankees moving west at the same time as these southerners sort of came west and northwest. And so the mingling of those cultures, this was in the 1800s primarily, but that kind of cultural history sort of lingers in this region. And so I always wanted to make sure that there was some of that represented in the region where I was looking. But geographically, I would generally say what the census describes as the Midwest. So from Ohio to the Great Plains states, and then from Minnesota. I do have one essay from Arkansas, and some parts of Arkansas share some of those cultural characteristics. But generally, we would go from kind of Minnesota to Missouri, perhaps.
We'll come back to it later, but London, and not London in Illinois or Ohio
we
or anything like
that
comes
that,
in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. One other definition, sort of, as we lay the groundwork. What do you consider literary? Because there is an expansive view of that as well here.
Yeah. So one of the challenges that I had as I was creating the series and thinking about the book project was that we started to be very limited to, say, the 20th century and later, 20th and 21st century. And that didn't sit right with me because I think there's a lot of literature produced in previous times. So I kind of expanded the idea to think about the kinds of writing that circulates maybe in and around, say, an English class, whether that's in a college or a high school, but something that you might bring in as context for that. So one example that a lot of people might not say is literary is like legal writing. So we have one essay on a woman named Rachel, who was a formerly enslaved woman. And this essay was by Christy Clark Buhara, who's a historian. And Rachel wrote a petition for her freedom. And I thought, okay, like this is one of the only sort of publicly available pieces of writing from Black women in the Midwest at this time. I thought this is an important context, and there's a way to think about the kind of writing that she was doing, not just, you know, not just limit ourselves to poetry or short stories or something like that.
Yeah, the things we recognize from English class. Let me ask you, let me remind listeners first, actually, that this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Andy Oler, who is a department chair and professor in humanities and communication at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach, Florida. And more to the point for our conversation, he's the editor of a collection coming out later this month from Three Fields Books, part of the U of I Press. It's called Lingering Inland, a literary tour of the Midwest. 800-222-9455. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. You open the book describing your own experience visiting a poet's house in Indiana when you were quite young, elementary school age, if I remember correctly. Talk about what you get out of visiting places associated with writers or their work.
Well, my experience in particular, I don't think I probably got as much out of it at the moment as maybe somebody who does when they're really actually thinking about it. But so my experience that I recount in the introduction, I did a media fair project. It was a little video on James Whitcomb Riley and his poetry. He's the Hoosier poet. And I talked about his poems. I talked about his life. and I gave a little background. And part of this I filmed right in front of the James Whitcomb Riley home in Greenfield, Indiana. And I have a fond memories of doing this. Unfortunately, the video is lost, but I think it shows when you go to a literary place of some kind, or you recognize that there's a literary place on your commute. I have one of those here where I live in Daytona Beach. It helps you think about the way that your place matters, the fact that people are willing to tell stories about it, and that it sticks around for long after that author wrote it, and probably long after you live there. And so I think that acknowledging and understanding that there are important stories being told about the place where you live or the places where you visit can help you really connect to that place and that culture and the people who are there all around you.
This is a digression again, but I'm curious, what is the literary place on your commute in Daytona Beach?
So I live in Ormond Beach, Florida, and I drive down to my campus in Daytona Beach, and I drive along the Intracoastal Waterway. And along there, Zora Neale Hurston, famous Florida writer, lived in a houseboat, I think, for a couple of years. And so I go right past, I mean, the marina has changed, but I go right past the marina where she lived on this houseboat. And it's crazy for me to think about Hurston being this just like titan of literature now, like someone we think of as a massive figure in the 20th century, kind of in this like forgotten little houseboat. And just like it, so it makes me really realize the way that stories live on.
Fascinating. So how do you decide what people and places to include in the book?
You know, the contributors decided a lot of that. I put out an idea for this series. And when I made the idea, I wanted to think about how to show how the stories we tell about our places, how they are relevant in our lives. And I realized that it couldn't just be me. Like, my voice wasn't enough. So I really relied on the contributor. So I put out a list. I said, hey, here's a bunch of authors and places that might work. But if you've got something that you're excited about, email me. We'll talk about it. We'll see if we can make it work. So most of the essays that I published came to me because someone said, oh, I worked in the library where James Emanuel spent, like in the town where he grew up, and he wrote this poem about the library. So I want to write about that. Or I went to this park that Langston Hughes mentions in a poem. I mean, there's all these kinds of stories. So most of the places really come from the contributors' personal experiences. And honestly, that's what sets this book apart from other books or websites that are focused on like literary places. A lot of those will give you a lot of great information about that place. It's kind of encyclopedic, and they're terrific resources. They're fun to read. They have good pictures. But what this one does is it provides that real personal angle. And so mostly I let them flow in. I did start to reach out to certain people, maybe that I knew, perhaps that they had written about some of those authors. But the key thing for me was always just making sure that there was that personal connection, not just to the literature, but also to the place.
I guess, and you're not going for an encyclopedia here, right? Because as I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, where's Saul Bellow? I'm looking for Nelson Algren and Hemingway and Luis Alberto Urrea and Rachel Lindsay. But as you say, it's what the contributors pitch in, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, I've got an ongoing list of people that I want to have contributors write about for Literary Landscapes, and hopefully we'll do another volume of this kind of a book in the future. But yeah, I couldn't possibly cover everything. I mean, if I tried to do that, it would be such a big, fat, heavy book, no one could ever pick it up. So I said, I say this in the intro, but I don't think that any one person or any one experience can really capture everything. And I don't think that this book is going to try to capture everything. But when you put all of these perspectives together, both the original authors that they're writing about, and then also the contemporary folks who are writing about these places and experience, when you put that all together, I think you do start to get a good mosaic understanding of the region. But there's absolutely gaps, and there are things that I would love to include, have included in the past, or to include in the future.
All right, we need to take a break in a couple of minutes, but so before we do, and we'll get into some of the individual essays and some of the authors when we return, but maybe we can just talk briefly about what, in your view, defines Midwestern identity, right? In the introduction, you have a line that the Midwest is a region that, like all regions, lays bare the desire for collectivity across vast landscapes. What does that mean?
Well, this goes back to what I was saying earlier in terms of the Midwest not having firm geographical boundaries. And it's not true of every place in the Midwest. I mean, you have river towns, you have Chicago on the lake, and everything kind of, you know, radiates out from the sort of the lake shore there. And those places have firm, careful identities that are pretty established and enduring. But when you look at the whole region, because you were not particularly bounded as a region, that tells me that to think of the Midwest as the Midwest, as a collective, people have to imagine that they have some connection to someone who is, you know, four or five states away, hundreds of miles from them, whose climate may be very different. But still, we tell these stories about ourselves. And so I don't think that I can pin down what is Midwestern identity. I don't think that that's necessarily possible in many respects. But I do see that willingness to make a connection and that interest in the place, but also an understanding that the place is not as fixed as some people would have it. I think those are some of the things that can become really important here.
All right, we'll get into more of this. The book is called Lingering Inland, A Literary Tour of the Midwest. We're speaking with the editor of this collection of essays. His name is Andy Oler. More to come here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking with Andy Oler, editor of a new collection of essays called Lingering Inland, A Literary Tour of the Midwest. It's a collection of short essays by contemporary writers exploring their literary peers and ancestors and this place that we call home. What Bob Dylan described as the country I come from is called the Midwest. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right, so there are a broad range of writers covered here, but a few of them, a select few, were selected by multiple contributors to this collection and get sort of little standout groupings. And among them is Willa Cather. Now, I might be revealing myself as a Philistine here, but I haven't thought too much about Willa Cather since freshman year of high school when I was forced to read my Antonia. So can you just remind us, who was Willa Cather? Why is she important in literature?
Well, Willa Cather was a Nebraska author of the early 20th century. And she is, to my mind, one of the most important authors in Midwestern literature. She wrote a lot about sort of pioneer life, I guess you would say, in the Nebraska plains. And actually, my Antonia is, for a long time, was my go-to book recommendation. I mean, maybe you didn't love it as a freshman in high school. I would understand that.
I think I wasn't ready for it. Yeah, it's probably more about
me. It is a lovely book. Yeah, I was TAing for a class in which our students read that book. And I remember the professor standing on stage and he read something aloud. He said, "Ooh, Willa Cather sure can write a sentence." And I hold on to that. I think that's true. But I wanted to think about, well, in this book, I wanted to represent a wide range of authors, but it's also important to notice and to recognize that some really important authors came out of this region as well. And so I chose Cather, Mark Twain, and Toni Morrison for this book. And we could have chosen any number of others to have a real focus on. Louise Erdrich is one who came to mind. There are lots of possibilities. Ernest Hemingway, like you mentioned. And you know, maybe in the next version we'll get some of those together. But with those canonical authors, I wanted to think about how their influence extends beyond their specific place. And so for Cather specifically, her essay or the essays about her go from Taos, New Mexico, all the way to Jaffrey, New Hampshire. She visited New Mexico at one point. She was out on the mesa. She wrote some letters about it. And the contributors had read those. They had visited the same places and they wanted to think about their experience in relation to hers. And so, one of the things I really see with Cather is she's got a really wonderful way of describing nature and the landscape and of just helping you imagine it just like that. And so I thought that she was a terrific person to not only represent the plains, but also to show how there's this really valuable connection to the land that goes through Midwestern literature.
I was intrigued by the section in Willa Cather, or I should say the short essay in Willa Cather's section on the Fine Arts Building in Chicago, which gets at this idea of Chicago as a hub for the Midwest with its railroad kingdom. And it's depicted as this great circulator of ideas, right? While at that time, others saw it as kind of a magnet attracting the strongest talent out of the hinterlands. Talk me through that.
Well, the let's see, that was Jesse Raber who wrote that
That's
piece.
right.
And he lives in Chicago and I think has, you know, gone to the Fine Arts Building a number of times. And he wrote about one of Cather's novels called Song of a Lark. And that's one of those stories, and there are a lot of them in the early 20th century where somebody from the country, whether that is you know, a small town in Kansas or you know the Nebraska plains or wherever, they go to the Midwest metropolis and they move to Chicago and there's going to be opportunity there, and then they get there and it's dirty and it's upsetting and it's scary, but then they find something and it becomes the city of excitement that they imagined it to be. And I can't remember the language of the passage specifically, but it kind of likens people to rivers in a way. Like there's a way that people will come together, and it might feel random. Like you watch a stream go, and you can't necessarily predict it, but it's all going to sort of join up to this large stream of humanity. And I love the way that Jesse talked about that, and I think it really shows some of the excitement of the connection between these different places.
Maybe we can also talk then about Mark Twain, who has a similarly expansive geography of Midwestern places here.
Twain, that one developed in a really interesting way because we've got two that are focused in Hannibal, Missouri, and then two that are focused in London, England. And that those sandwich Elmira, New York, and Hartford, Connecticut. So Twain is, you know, when a lot of people think of him as almost this Midwestern river figure, in that kind of Huck Finn, so I guess the reputation of Huck Finn lasting so long and being so powerful. And he is that, and that's where he came from. But he also spent a lot of time out west and he traveled the world and he lived for certain periods of time in London, in different parts of London. And most of his adult life he spent living in Connecticut. And so I wanted to think about Twain's origins. And so we've got his boyhood home represented here in an essay by Cindy Lovell. But in Hannibal, the other thing we've got is the Mark Twain Cave. And so it's this place that there was a story told about, right, in Tom Sawyer, but it also became a tourist attraction. And so you think about how the lives of these authors change and develop and what they mean to people over time. And I reached out to some of the folks in this. Susan Kumin Harris wrote a really good book about Twain's travels all over the world, and she had gone along that route, and I thought, oh, she's gonna, you know, pick somewhere in East Asia to write about or something. But no, she didn't. She picked one of the homes that he lived in London, and I also had someone else who wanted to write about London. I thought, you know what? These are two different times of his life. They have different stories to tell about it, and these people, these contributors, have their own personal perspectives. And it's a really fun collection of essays, because it goes from everything from this boyhood home to this sort of like late life mansion, and people have really cool stories to tell about each of them.
You know, it's interesting considering some of the writers here are, and there's a line in some film or musical or something, and I've been scratching my head trying to place it, and I haven't been able to do so, but it's like, you ever notice how many people say they're from the Midwest, but they're no longer in the Midwest? And I think, yeah. I mean, you yourself are living proof of that. Talk about what role that plays in the literature and in some of these essays here.
That's an interesting question. When I try to think about the whole group of essays, I would say most of the people who wrote these essays are still living in the Midwest, but then there is a large group, and I myself included, that are thinking back on the time that they spent in the Midwest, or whether that was growing up, or, you know, when they were in college, or when they lived in, you know, St. Louis for a period, their grandparents or whatever. But there's an important, I think, thread that runs through this book, two. One, of people who have this daily experience of the Midwest, and another, of people who are looking back on their experience and drawing meaning from things that happened in the past. And so there's a way that a line of nostalgia runs through this book. I think that a lot of the contributors cut through that, because this is not a book that is simply boosting the reputation of the Midwest. I mean, lots of individuals, lots of stories, people deal with hard things, both in real life here and in the essays in this book. But there is that kind of fondness and consideration over time that can come from people who have left, whether that's permanently or temporarily.
And another through line is sort of, and maybe this gets at, you know, sort of the expansive view of that people were approaching this work with, is injustice then, injustice now, right? Sojourner Truth in particular, yeah. In Michigan, who, you know, is, I think, not best known for her writing, although that is an important part of her story. But it connects to some of the injustice people are fighting against today.
Yeah, absolutely. One good example of that is one of the Indianapolis essays on Booth Tarkington. It's written by Wes Bishop, who's a historian, and he wrote it during COVID. He edited a little bit for the book version, so it wasn't quite as, you know, focused on that particular time. But he was watching some of the way that the sort of streets kind of emptied out, and he was watching some of the unrest that happened at the same time. And he was thinking about how that in some ways was similar to the world that Tarkington tells us about in Indianapolis. So, I mean, his is just about a street in Indianapolis, and he brings in all of this history, including his own personal experience of the place. So, yeah, absolutely.
One of the other characters that struck me here was Elijah Lovejoy, who is a man who's probably more famous for his murder and how he was murdered and what happened in relation to that than he was for anything he actually wrote on the page. And I guess this gets back to that earlier idea we talked about of a sort of broad view of what constitutes literature and literary life. But can you talk about his story briefly?
Well, Lovejoy was a newspaper publisher, and he was an abolitionist, and remember the details. I think he kind of got run out of St. Louis by pro-slavery forces, and then he started up his newspaper again in Alton, Illinois, and then was murdered there for that. And so Evan Allen Wood writes about actually the memorial to Lovejoy that is in Alton. I think it's at his gravesite, if I remember correctly. And he's trying to think about, like, this person who was pushed aside, who was chased out, but who now has this memorial for them. And what does it mean to remember something? And how do we decide what grabs our attention now, or what's important to us now versus what that will be a few decades into the future? And certainly those are some of the questions that wind through a lot of essays here. I mean, especially when you get essays about, say, author houses that have been demolished. Like, they may go to a street and there's an empty lot there and say, okay, here's what used to be here, and here's why that's still significant, even though we can't see it as it was.
The collection is called Lingering Inland, A Literary Tour of the Midwest. The editor is Andy Oler. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today on the 21st Show.
Oh, absolutely, my pleasure.
Should say this. Oh, this book is coming out December 23rd. You can find it from Three Fields Books, which is part of the University of Illinois Press. And that is it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, the Trump administration is rolling back the State Department's use of the Calibri font to the classic Times New Roman, saying it's a more formal and professional and a wasteful form of DEI. We'll talk about what sparked that switch and what makes some fonts better than others. We're also going to talk about a man who is taking on the authorities in Danville over police stops. He says disproportionate numbers of police stops of African Americans there. That's all coming up tomorrow here on the 21st Show. Before we go, I want to urge you to join our texting group. We love sharing your comments and questions on the show. You can do that by sending the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, the word is TALK to 217-803-0730. You can also find that and every other way to contact us on our website, 21stshow.org. We've also got links to our podcasts there, or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Malkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Kulsum Khan. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.